Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, where our job is to help you build visibility, professional credibility, and connection with your ideal client by putting the human at the center of innovative marketing, so you can build and strengthen an engaging, enduring relationship with your ideal clients. I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm honored that you're here with me. If you haven't joined our wonderful marketing transformation community yet, go to innovabiz.co and collect your free gift as well. Do subscribe to the show and also leave a review because it helps others find us. Let's get into today's masterclass on this InnovaBuzz podcast.
Trying to figure out a new market is different than an existing one. In a new market, you want to get outside to understand the day in the life of the customer now and be able to articulate what's going to happen when your new product changes this entire industry. What else needs to change? What kind of behavior needs to change?
Welcome back. I hope you've had an awesome week so far. If you haven't yet listened to my recent conversations with Mark Schaefer, author of Marketing Rebellion, and with Rob Thomas, author of Who Do You Need to Meet, then do check them out. But only after you've listened to today's conversation, of course. I'm really excited to have on the InnovaBuzz podcast as my guest today, entrepreneur turned educator, Steve Blank. Steve is known as the father of modern entrepreneurship. He's credited with launching the lean startup movement. He's changed how startups are built, how entrepreneurship is taught, how science is commercialized, and how companies and the government innovate. Steve is the author of The Four Steps to the Epiphany, the Startup Owner's Manual, and his May 2013 Harvard Business Review cover story defined the lean startup movement. He teaches at Stanford and at Columbia University, where he is a senior fellow for entrepreneurship. He created the National Science Foundation Innovation Corps, now the standard for science commercialization in the US. His Hacking for Defense class at Stanford is revolutionizing how the US defense and intelligence community can deploy innovation with speed and urgency. And its sister classes, including Hacking for Diplomacy, Hacking for Oceans, Hacking for Local, and now Hacking for Survival, are doing the same for other real-world challenges. In our discussion today, Steve talked to me about being a fact-based rather than faith-based business. He says that there are no facts inside your building. He explained why customer discovery and lean methodology are more important than ever in these radically changed times, and what businesses can do to reinvent and reimagine themselves for the post-COVID world. Without further ado, then, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Steve Blank. Hi. I'm your host, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited today to welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast all the way from Pescadero in California, Steve Blank. Steve is the father of modern entrepreneurship. He launched the lean startup movement. He's changed how startups are built, how entrepreneurship is taught, how science is commercialized, and how companies and governments innovate. So I'm really excited to have the chance to actually speak to him and learn a lot more about the background to the lean startup method. Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, Steve. It's a real privilege to have you as my guest.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm great to be here.
Alex Osterwalder, who was our guest on episode 293 of the InnovaBuzz podcast, suggested that we have a conversation with you, Steve. So a big hello and shout out to Alex.
That's great. I would have suggested you should have a conversation with Alex. Or even, you know, the lean startup. A third of lean is Alex's work, and every day it becomes more and more as he keeps writing more books.
Yeah, 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 his and some of his latest books are just fascinating. How he breaks it down using the visual components and making it really easy to understand for everybody.
Right. So Alex managed to turn my turgid 400-page text into like you know, a series of pretty pictures that anybody can understand. you know, it was lucky for everybody. We kind of combined. It was like peanut butter and jelly getting together.
Yeah, fascinating. Now, you know, you've got a really interesting background, moving from being an entrepreneur and starting up so many different businesses, and then teaching at Stanford and Berkeley and Columbia, and among other things. Also, the whole aspect of customer development model that you developed early on, and then the lean startup. So it's sort of fascinating to reflect back on that. Most people know about the lean startup. I'm not sure they know of you as the founder and father of that. What I'm curious about is, how do you describe the lean startup in very short sort of outline form?
Yeah, so the lean startup, as you mentioned, came from my experience as a serial entrepreneur. I did 8 startups in 21 years in Silicon Valley, everything from supercomputers to semiconductors, even video games, enterprise software. And, you know, when you're an entrepreneur, your head is kind of down. You don't get to think about, you know, strategic thoughts other than those about your business. And certainly you're not thinking about how to reform, you know, the entire nature of startups. But when I retired, I got lucky enough to retire when I was fairly young at 45, I really started thinking about the nature of innovation and entrepreneurship. And what I realized is that that the emperor had no clothes, is that what investors had been telling us as entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley, which is where I live and practiced, was essentially, without ever saying these exact words, in the 20th century, investors were saying startups are nothing more than smaller versions of large companies. And everything a large company does, you, Mr. Entrepreneur or innovator, you should do as well. They write a business plan, you should write a business plan. They do a 5-year forecast, you should do a 5-year forecast. They hire sales, marketing, biz dev on day one, you obviously need those at day one. And of course, you know, everything you wrote in your business plan, if we fund it, your job is simply to build it. So get to work, you know, use a waterfall methodology of, you know, write a functional spec, hire engineering, build a product, and then alpha test, beta test, first customer ship it. And if you did that, they would have said you were a genius. But what I observed is, by the time I retired after a couple decades of doing this, is startups aren't smaller versions of large companies. Large companies at their core execute known business models. You got large because you figured out who your customers are and what features they want and what distribution channel to use and who your competitors are and pricing, regulatory issues, etc. Obviously, you innovate, but at the core, it's a repeatable process. And so this difference between search and execution, that is, large companies execute business models, but startups search for them. Yet we had spent 100 years building tools and techniques for execution. There really was no formal methodology for searching for a business model. Because any entrepreneur who had done an early stage venture will tell you, no business plan survives first contact with customers. That is, you write it, you know, because investors need it and they knew nothing else to ask you. So you gave it to them and they nod and you turn it into a set of PowerPoint slides. And if the font looked good and you were articulate, you might have gotten a check. And I was pretty good at that. But then you kind of threw that plan aside and then you just went into execution mode, like just like everybody else. But I realized that the difference between the winners and losers of innovators was those who kind of tossed those rules aside and said, we have on day one a set of assumptions, a fancy term when I teach at Stanford because the students pay a lot of money, is I use the word hypotheses, but that essentially messes we're just effing guessing about a set of things. We might have a few knowns, maybe we have some core technology we know, or maybe we have an insight about the market, but almost everything else in a new venture and big idea, whether it's an innovative thing inside of a large company or certainly in a startup, are a series of untested hypotheses. Yet we had no methodology. We didn't even have the permission to go out and test them. And so what I invented was what I called a customer development methodology, and now I'm getting to some of your question, is the lean consists of three pieces. The first piece is called customer development, which says there is no facts inside your building, so get the heck outside. It's a big idea. To start a new venture, either inside or outside a company, you have to believe you're a visionary. But the data says after about 75 years of venture capital and innovation starts of large companies, that about 98% of visionaries are actually hallucinating on day one. And so the whole purpose of customer development is to turn a faith-based enterprise into a fact-based enterprise as rapidly as possible. Because what used to happen is, we would build the product with waterfall engineering. After a year or two, we'd ship it, and then we'd find out that no one wanted it or needed it, or the feature set was wrong, or it was too late, or competitors had something different, or we just kind of missed the big opportunity. So customer development was a way to get out of the building and understand those. And when I started teaching that at Berkeley, one of my best students was someone named Eric Ries, and I had sat on the board of Eric's company, IMVU, and kind of funded it. And Eric became the first practitioner of customer development and had the incredible insight, which I didn't have the experience of, is Steve. In the 21st century, engineers are now using agile engineering, building products iteratively and incrementally rather than in waterfall. And this would work for hardware or software products. Gee, combining customer development and agile engineering, would make a powerful combination. And so step two in lean startup is get out of the building. But as you're getting out of the building, use agile engineering to build something called minimum viable products. Not only talk to customers, but actually show them incremental and iterative progress. And it doesn't have to be a defeatured product. It could be a cardboard mock-up or a wireframe or a core part of machinery or some small part of an assembly line or something to get immediate feedback. And what's nice about these MVPs is you could constantly iterate them, instead of waiting a year and a half until you ship the wrong thing that people didn't need. And a couple other consequences happened because of this is that if you find out that you're wrong, that is, if you have a bunch of data that says, well, I thought the customers were here, but they're actually over here, or no, I got the right customers, but they really want features 3, 9, and 12, you're allowed to do something called a pivot, which is probably the best invention of the 21st century. The pivot says you're allowed to be wrong without getting fired because you didn't spend 2 years building the darn thing. You've been quickly learning, and a pivot says, we got some new data, so let's dump these other 7 features and focus on these, and now we can move forward faster and know when we ship that product, people are going to grab it out of our hands, and the biggest problem we're going to have is where do the bags of money go in our building? The third piece of this was that, okay, we have all these hypotheses, we're getting out of the building and testing them, and we're using agile engineering to build the product and test minimum viable products and see if we want to pivot, but how do we kind of keep track of what hypotheses we should be testing? And that's when I discovered Alexander Osterwalder's work in the business model canvas. And Osterwalder's canvas is a single, I'm sure as your listeners know, as he described the last week, it's just a single piece of paper that has 9 boxes on it that is essentially about 80 to 90% of the things you ought to be checking when you're doing something new. Who are the customers? What's the value proposition? Fancy word for what features or services do they want? What's the distribution channel to reach them? How do you get, keep, and grow them? What's the revenue model? What resources and activities do you need to do? What kind of partners and what are the costs? Now, all of a sudden, with the business model canvas, we have the third part of lean. We had a way to track all these hypotheses we're supposedly getting out of the building and testing and showing people MVPs. So lean, to answer your very short question in a long soliloquy, is the three components of business model canvas, customer development, and agile engineering to allow companies to minimize the amount of time, resources, dollars spent on innovative new things as they're searching for the right business model.
Well, thanks for that explanation. That's really
good, and it ties together, you know, the work of three of the, I mean, I see pioneers of this whole philosophy of lean startup and how to present it in a really smart way so that you can actually use it and learn from it. One of the follow-up questions, I guess, is how do you see businesses have embraced this, and what, you know, what have been some of the hurdles to get businesses to understand that this is the better way to do business for small business in particular going forward in the 21st century?
Well, so the whole notion of lean, and I think Alex on your show talked about the you know, allowing yourself to be humiliated, you know, inside of the company. I'd use the word allow yourself to be humiliated. But the whole notion of lean does require yourself to say, perhaps I'm wrong. It doesn't mean I want you to second guess yourself, but it does require a change in the traditional product management structure that says, look, we came up with this functional spec because sales or marketing or engineering said this is our next product or wherever it came from. So let's go build it, and you know, and maybe we'll ask some customers when we're 3/4 of the way down. Lean kind of turns that on its head. It says, no, we can have all these great thoughts and from sales or engineering or whatever, but why don't we have a continual process of customer interaction from day one? What we want to build is something that people, you know, their pupils dilate and they grab you by the collar and say, you can't leave until I have this in the product. No, I'll give you money now. But the odds of getting that right on the first shot, you know, not zero, but boy, if I was a betting man, I'd be betting against you. And so this is just a way to kind of optimize hitting the target more often. And so lean requires kind of a little humility, not humiliation, but humility that keeps going back to there are no facts inside the building. So, and by the way, every once in a while, I kind of get in the middle of these conversations where I'm sitting in a room with some very smart people and I kind of look up and say, well, are we having a faith-based conversation or a fact-based conversation? Because no one here has any facts. You know, the first one, including my admin, you know, who comes in with a fact, kind of like wins the argument. Because, and this is what people forget, is I'll agree that you're the smartest person in the conference room. In fact, you're probably the smartest person in the entire building and maybe even in the entire company. But unless you're going to be the purchaser of the entire output of these products, you don't really matter here. All you have is an untested set of opinions. So why don't you humor me? You are convinced you're 100% right. Why don't we go outside and start talking to people? And if they say, oh, yes, then these are exactly the features or the price or the channel and whatever, boom, then you're validated. We could all go back to work. And of course, when you run that exercise, you know, like smoke comes out of people's ears because when they get out of the building, and by the way, you can't outsource this. This is not a giant focus group. It's the people who are leading, either the founders of the company or inside, the people who are running the exercise of the new product. They have to be the ones talking to people directly because, first of all, what will happen is when they hear discordant opinions from what they have, cognitive dissonance will set in. And the first thing they'll do is go, well, these people don't get it. Let me talk to someone else. Well, these people, and then after a while, they'll go, oh my gosh, you know. And then the second and most important thing about having people with authority doing this is they could pivot in the field. Instead of asking Mother May I back in the home office or back in the factory, they could go in front of a customer that says, huh, well, that's interesting. It's too bad you don't like the product. Well, what if we turned it on its head, added this feature or this conveyor belt or this, you know, whatever? And someone might say, oh, well, why didn't you tell me that in the first place? I'd buy 1,000 of those.
Yeah.
If you don't have the authority to kind of make a pivot, that doesn't mean you have to build it, but you do have to have both the knowledge and the authority to kind of test alternatives literally in front of a customer. And that's when things become fun. And that's how founders and new projects inside of large corporations end up scaling. Did that answer a question or
question? Yep, that's certainly did. And I mean, I think back to an exercise that we did in my corporate career back in the mid-1990s, and I hadn't discovered Lean at that stage, but we came up with this concept of developing products from the outset with customers, getting customer input, sitting down with customers, and it was a big challenge to bring that through. I mean, we developed the system, but to get that through, because what would happen typically was the salespeople would be the in-person conduit to the customer, and they would then bring into the company, hey, this is the sort of product that the customer is looking for. So there'd be a filter there applied. Then they'd pass that on to the marketing people, who'd then have meetings with research and key decision makers in the business group to come up with the next product. And then we'd build the product. And then at some point, maybe at a prototype stage, it would go to a customer who would then come back and say, no, you're way off the mark here. And of course, it would go through filters everywhere. And this just, first of all, it took ages. And like you said earlier, it often missed the mark completely. So when we sort of turned this around, it took projects that were like 5 years in gestation and multiple millions of dollars down to the first one we actually did with it turned out to be a 9-month turnaround to a commercial product, including scale up, which was, you know, a big manufacturing effort, because everybody was involved at the beginning, including the customer, and all the decision makers were there, like you said. So that was, to me, a real powerful lesson. But to get to that point, there were a lot of egos that had to be kind of overcome and put aside.
Yeah, so Jürgen, in fact, I should be interviewing you. That's a perfect story. And I think that's the distinction, what you just said. It's not only egos, it's a whole existing process that exists in large corporations. And you just described, by the way, why startups could look like a blur to a large company, right? To a startup, if the CEO says, you know, here's what we're doing from day one, there is no culture to kind of change. That is the culture you build into the company on day one. And remember, I don't have to remind your listeners, in a large company, 90 some odd percent, whether it's 99 or 95% of people come to work to do a job, right? They punch in at 9, go home at 5, and there's a process and a procedure, and it's an execution job. But here now we're describing something different, right? We're saying, listen, I don't want to screw up your execution job, but this is a different model for innovation. And how you kind of, I have found, engage sales and marketing is it requires both a culture change and education and incentives to make that work. If people's incentives are in large corporations are to build empires and control data, which is typically what happens for either personal gain or ego gain, you know, this is not just a innovation problem. It's an HR problem, a finance problem, a C-suite problem. And you could do this, but you got to understand that you're fighting against an execution culture where an innovation culture doesn't even exist. And I don't mean that the company isn't innovative, but they haven't made the distinction between execution and innovation. And that is one of the biggest failures of large corporations who want to innovate, is to understand that you need to run two different cultures in parallel. One is the people who are like paying your current salary versus the people who eventually, if they're right, are going to be paying your pension, which are the innovators. And they need different permissions, different rules, different whatever. But in my opinion, you don't want the whole company to do that. You want this process to be able to do that for the people in the innovate, what we call the innovation pipeline. And so the more time I spend in large organizations, I find that distinction, which people in the 20th century had already started talking about, called the ambidextrous organization, that is the ability to execute and innovate in parallel, is just something that most corporations have not formalized. And that's why you get into these kind of arguments with the execution arms of, well, sales in charge of the account, or marketing is responsible for X and Y. Well, yes, for 95% of the things, that's what sales is in charge for. But no, for these 5% of the things, no, you're not in charge of that at all. Here's the other organization. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we were having those conversations at the time, saying that, you know, there's kind of almost a different set of rules for this little innovation hub. So yeah, it's fascinating.
Yeah, and by the way, here's the big idea, is that people in the 20th century, Tushman and O'Reilly in particular, one from, I think, Stanford, the other from, I believe, MIT or Harvard, coined this phrase, the ambidextrous organization. But in the 20th century, it was kind of optional if you were a big company. Who'd you compete with? You competed with other big companies, and they kind of were screwed up like you were. I mean, in a nice way. They operated at the same clock speed with the same technology, and then that was fine. But now in the 21st century, you know, I don't have to tell your listeners that large companies or companies of all sizes are dealing with things that in the 20th century, like you never had to even think about. Startups with more capital than Fortune 100 companies, you know, competition from China, opportunities in globalization. Now we're dealing with COVID-19 and a pandemic. I mean, all these things require a different way to think about how we innovate. In fact, what I remind some of the large organizations I work with, if you got your, you know, MBA more than 5 years ago, it's most of it's probably obsolete, other than the accounting, stuff. And I don't mean that it's obsolete that you're dumb. It's that the world has changed radically, and that what you as a leader need to understand for innovation in large organizations is that you're being disrupted from all. We hear this word disruption, but we could quantify it to really. You can meet with any startups this year, or things moving a lot faster, or what's the web done to your distribution channel, or, your brand used to mean something. Now all of a sudden people could create pop-up brands overnight. I mean, a whole list of things that are just making innovators and CEOs of existing companies kind of have their heads spin around. And so it requires new processes and procedures to kind of formalize, much like we did for startups, that large companies need to start embracing these things.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a really good point. I think one of the questions I had, because if you think about all that disruption and so on, that's been going on for some time, probably since the first dot-com boom and the internet came on and people had access to a lot more information, and suddenly it was a lot easier to cooperate across geographical boundaries. But I'm not sure that everybody adopted that philosophy that, hey, we're being disrupted from all sides now, and so we have to change some things, change our philosophies. Whether that was adopted really quickly, that was kind of a slow process that started seeping through in various places. But now we've got COVID, we've got the pandemic, we've got lockdowns, we've got the inability to actually gather in large numbers and go out and talk to people face to face as much, and people are being forced to work from home, do remote work, and so on. So now it's like we're being forced to make changes that beforehand maybe were slow to seep through a big organization. How do you see that playing out now, in terms of the impact of COVID on large organizations and how business is done going forward?
You know, at least here in the U.S., that's a great question. I've seen obviously the effect for existing companies three different ways, right? And some lucky segment, business is booming. Whether food delivery or whatever, it doesn't mean it's profitable, but it means it's booming. For a good number of businesses, they're worried about health and safety. Manufacturing plants are having to install partitions or other safety measures. And then there's another segment, unfortunately, at least in the U.S., getting larger. If people are sequestering, and you own restaurants or travel businesses, there is no pivot or safety measure. You don't have any customers. You're figuring out whether you're just going out of business, and hoping you could get some support from the government. So within that, though, the key measure for those companies that are looking for how do you survive in this business, the ones that can survive, is can you come up with new innovative business models or new ways to serve customers and test those ideas rapidly to stay in business? One of the surprises for me is that one of the key parts of lean customer discovery and customer development assume that you have to get outside the building and physically talk to people. Yet here we are on a video conference or people are using Zoom or Microsoft Teams or other ways to actually communicate in a way that most people didn't think they'd ever be able to do. And so what we've discovered is, as the punchline, customer discovery for first level interactions with customers are equal to or more effective than in-person meetings. It's a big idea. And the reason why I say more effective is sitting in your living room in your bedroom slippers, you could probably talk to 2 to 3 times more people than you could driving around your city or town, or flying, for gosh sake, anywhere. Even when the crisis is over, I now tell all the companies I'm involved in, you know, I don't care who it is, but you're no longer taking a first meeting, you know, in person. The video conferencing is now good enough that you could actually see someone's pupils dilate and see if they're looking at their watch or rolling their eyes, and good enough for a first meeting. Number one is you want to be able to do some discovery about what possible new business models might you have. And using Osterwalder's Canvas, you could start running a series of experiments about, okay, you know, what if we did X, or what if we delivered Y, or what if we built an MVP that looked like this. And in fact, at Stanford, we're running a series of 5-day classes for existing businesses and people who want to create new ones called Hacking for Recovery. That's a free online class. If you go to Hacking for Recovery at Stanford, you'll find a sign up for the class. And we're allowing teams to come in, teams of 4 people, to kind of take a new business model or modify an existing one and run customer discovery and use agile engineering to build MVPs and to get out of the building and test those ideas. But I think every large company or every small business and every startup needs to be thinking about, you know, what's the world going to look like in 3 months and 6 months and in the coming years? I don't think it's going to be the same for most segments. And I think this is kind of a mass extinction event for a series of industries, which unfortunately will eliminate a series of businesses, but more importantly, create a whole new category of businesses that never existed before. You know, in the U.S., the rules have changed dramatically for telemedicine, and people think it's just the video conferencing. It's actually the government's, at least in the U.S., allowing you to get reimbursed if you're a doctor or some kind of clinician to practice over Zoom or something else. I think it's changing the nature of work. I'm not sure people are going to think that they need to drive 45 minutes to go into an office. Now, to read email and use video conferencing and drive another 45 minutes to do that again. I think what we're going to find is, you know, people are happy to come in 2 days a week to kind of maybe conference and network when this is all over. But I think this has been a giant sociological experiment about configurations of workplaces. Obviously, there are some businesses that are not office workers, like manufacturing and others, food services, where you have to be in physical proximity. But I think we're going through and will go through a rapid reconfiguration of the nature of work, which means opportunities for both existing companies and new ventures.
Yeah, and I'm hearing lots of discussions around, you know, the office-based work environments as to how that might look in the future and how, you know, the people like family and in that are still in employ and working in those kind of areas, how they're seeing the future and how those companies are discussing that in terms of, you know, the impact that has on their bottom line as well as the productivity of the people. So all of a sudden they don't need these large office spaces anymore, or they don't need to pay allowances for food, or they don't need to provide other services that they have been providing in the past. But so they offset that by subsidizing each employee's home office equipment so that they can do more work from home, and they suddenly find that it's a lot more productive if they do. Well, they're being forced to work from home, but they're finding productivity gains in that. So they're talking about exactly what you're saying. You know, let's have let's explore the idea of maybe two days a week in the office where people have those personal physical interactions, but then the rest of the time at home.
But you know, one of the things that people are not talking about when we talk about the future work is that has ripple effects through other parts of the economy, right? There were people who were cleaning those offices. There were restaurants around the building that depended on workers being there days a week for lunches.
There's people who own the buildings that rent them out. There's office space everywhere, right?
Right. So again, for some people, as I said, these are going to be kind of extinction level events. But for others, these are going to be real opportunities. So, okay, well, how do you provide those services to people at home? You know, maybe they need food services as they're being delivered. Maybe you could convince the businesses, well, they're working and they're working from home. Why don't we provide them lunch there as a benefit? But my point is that instead of just randomly throwing stuff at the wall, you could use a methodology like Lean to start testing a whole series of like, well, what if we did X? What if we did Y? Instead of just sitting around the conference room kind of brainstorming, is okay, how do we test these quickly without building an entire infrastructure or changing our entire business? And by the way, you know, building a minimum viable product is not just let's test the product and service, but it could be, okay, let's test the spreadsheet. Let's assume this works. So what's the new, you know, income statement and balance sheet and cash flow look like? Ah, well, even if it worked, we're still out of business. All right, let's try something else. And so this whole idea of have a hypothesis, test it, get out of the building, build MVPs, you know, now it's more urgent than ever. It's now not a nice to have for some businesses, survival. And by the way, the other category is if you're lucky enough to be in a booming business, I'd be using the canvas again for the same thing, is that except this time, there's now people you could never hire that you could hire. I mean, you never would think you could acquire these kinds of people. You know, there are buildings you could buy or resources or factories or things if you happen to be in that lucky segment that, you know, that people are eventually going to need these services again. So there's opportunities for smart companies to take advantage of that. Also, I remind people who are, at least in the United States, a good number of students are deciding that next year when classes are still virtual, they'll take a gap year, or that is a leave of absence. Well, that leaves schools with holes in their recruiting, which means students who could never get into some of the top universities should now be applying.
Yeah, yeah.
because it's an opportunity of a lifetime. If you want to pay, you know, full tuition and go to name of a great university virtually, that'll just be for a year, because in the next couple of years, it'll come back physically and you'll be on a campus you never could have gotten into, which is what I remind students.
Yeah, well, there's a whole lot of opportunities there, isn't it? So it's a kind of how you look at that and then how you sort of take those opportunities and test them out very quickly. Yeah, great advice.
So one of the things, by the way, we're doing is this Hacking for Recovery. One of the states in the United States, Hawaii, is completely dependent on tourism, and they have locked down the state, not letting any tourists come in. And unemployment is probably north of 25%. And so they're going to be running Hacking for Recovery classes based around this whole Lean model for existing employers and people who want to create new businesses to figure out, you know, what's plan B? Is there a way to kind of make money and kind of restart the economy using Lean methodology? And we're going to be helping them run that in the next couple of months.
Interesting to see how that pans out, because I mean Australia's got a big tourism industry too, and they've been hit really hard by the pandemic, because we're not allowing international travel in or out other than returning citizens. And there's some interesting things some of the tourism people are doing, and I see that as being a little bit of a Lean thing. So and the online space gives you the opportunity to put something up very quickly and test it out and see what response you get. So yeah, it's fascinating. All right, well, this is fabulous, Steve. I could go on for ages talking about how Lean applies, particularly today in our current environment, but I'm aware of the time. So I think it's a good point to move on to the Buzz, which is our innovation round, and it's designed to help our audience, who are primarily innovators and leaders in their field, with some tips from your experience. So I've got five questions for you. Hopefully you'll give us some answers that will inspire our listeners to go and do something awesome as a result today.
Let's see if I can help.
What do you think the number one thing anyone needs to do to be more innovative is?
I think it's been a constant theme in my conversation just realize that as smart as you are, there are no facts inside your building.
Hmm.
And by the way, this is a compliment to all your listeners. The smarter you are, the harder it is for you to embrace this idea.
Hmm.
Because if you're really smart, you think, well, how hard is this? When you propose a solution, what you don't understand is you're actually saying, without ever saying it out loud, I deeply understand the customer's problem. So therefore, here's the solution they need. Rather than going, maybe I really don't understand the customer's problem. Part of getting out of the building is understand the problem and then test the solution. So I think that's my answer to your first question.
Mm, love it. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think part of understanding the problem to me is going out and talking to people who have the problem and asking lots of questions, which imply at that point that you're actually not that smart about that particular topic.
Right. But it's really hard given how smart people think they are. Well, of course, I have this job. This is my title. Haven't you read my business card? It says so right here. I'm in charge of X, or I'm and you know what? No one cares, right? Unless you get to wrap your business card around every new product saying, buy it because here's who I am. It doesn't work that way.
We have this saying in some of the training we do related to mindset stuff, and it's leave your ego at the door. And I think that's probably something that you could apply to a lot of situations.
But that's really hard, and I want to admit it's hard. And the toughest part about lean and getting out of the building is not that it's technically difficult. It just, as you just pointed out, it is a mindset thing. It is, and in fact, you tend to find excuses. Well, I can understand this works for existing product, but gee, we're creating something new in a new market. Gee, Steve Jobs or Henry Ford would have, said we need a horse with six legs if I would have talked to customers. Why would I talk to anybody to ask them about something new? Well, of course, trying to figure out a new market is different than an existing one. In a new market, you want to get outside to understand the day in the life of the customer now and be able to articulate what's going to happen when your new product changes this entire industry. What else needs to change? What kind of behavior needs to change? No, you can't ask them, do you want something 10% faster if that thing had never existed? But for existing or new markets, the same process works. Sorry, I got off your first question.
Yeah. No, that's good. And I think, if we talked about smart people, I think the being smart is knowing that you don't know everything here and you need to ask more questions. And the smart part then comes about, okay, how can you connect the dots between here's the problem that the customer has that I think I have some expertise to be able to help solve that problem, and connecting the dots to something that is a future state product service that they maybe don't even imagine is possible.
And what you just pointed out, Jürgen, is that customer development outside the building is not a giant focus group. Its goal is, in fact, to inform the founder's insight, to help them extract some insight out of the data they're gathering, not make a master list of all the possible feature requests. That's what focus groups do. This is quite different. So getting out of the building is not a giant focus group. See, here's what everybody asked for, and here's what sales asked for. This is what marketing wants. I did customer development. No. It's to deeply understand the problem and go, oh, wait a minute. What they've just been describing is a symptom of the problem. The problem is actually much bigger, or the problem is over here, or the problem's not a product problem at all. The problem is a security problem or a policy problem or some kind of organizational problem. All right, question two.
Yeah, question two. Okay, what's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
Well, I have declared since day one that I am not very innovative. but I'm a great synthesizer. You know, this whole lean thing was built on the shoulders of everybody else. Customer development was built on reading a ton of literature, starting with Rita McGrath's work on the leader user research and a ton of others. You know, it was Eric Ries's observation about Agile and customer development that got paired, and then discovering Osterwalder stuff. It's been talking to large organizations and finding out that, no, this is a cultural and HR and incentive problem. You don't change people's, you know, job description or change their incentives. They're going to keep working the same way they've always been working. And so, you know, I guess the biggest thing for me was learning from others and being, you know, there are times, to be honest, I was the smartest person in the room. And that actually was a trap. Because then I would go, well, you know, I have all the answers. When in fact, that was digging myself a very deep hole. Because, of course, as I said earlier, that I wasn't buying the products. I wasn't talking to the people who were. So that's my answer for two.
Great. So lots of reading, learning, studying other people's work, and having the humility, as you put it early in our conversation, to accept that there was a contribution there that you could take on board and then synthesize something from.
And during what you just made me think is the addition to that, the underlying theme is, if you're an innovator and you're not curious about lots of stuff, you're not an innovator.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, people talk about entrepreneurs being agile and relentless and yeah. I mean, that's the checklist. But curiosity about lots of things, if you're just not naturally curious, you'll tend to shut down when you think you have sufficient data. Thank you very much. I got the answer. Okay, here, let me go back. Rather than keeping asking some questions about, well, why are you doing this? Or, you know, what are they? You know, it goes back to those classic five why questions. About, well, why is that? Why is it? You know, what caused that? And if that doesn't make you excited, then you ought to go into finance or something.
The five whys. I love the five whys.
Yeah, it's great, man. But if that's not an exciting thing, is when you ask those five whys, you're actually playing detective. And you can't be a detective unless you kind of enjoy like learning new things and going, whoa, you know, my assumption was here, but look, the dog didn't bark. What happened?
Yeah, it's fascinating. All right. Do you have a favorite resource you use most often?
Well, besides the web, resource in what?
Just something that gives you new ideas or makes you more productive.
You know, I read a ton of blogs, as I said. You know, I read Alexander Osterwalder's blogs, Rita McGrath's blogs. Eric Ries has some nice stuff. I read a ton of VC blogs. You know, I read a lot of corporate innovation blogs. And I'm always kind of thinking, and I'm always reading new books on innovation. The nice part is we all tend to stand on each other's shoulders. What was really nice about what happened with Lean is, you know, before my work, there was just very few books for entrepreneurs or in startups. Now there's hundreds, maybe thousands of things in the last two decades. It kind of makes me smile. Actually, I feel quite proud. And so I get to read what other people have kind of done with our work. And a lot of it is actually quite innovative thinking. So I guess the answer is I tend to read everything. I guess that's my best resource.
Yeah. And having access, well, through the internet, I mean, it's just amazing how easily you can access a variety of information.
Yes.
All right. Now, what's the best way to keep a project on track when we get to this? Okay, here's an idea. Here's the lean methodology. This is the feedback we've got. Here's the pivot we're going to make. What's the best way to keep that on track?
Well, in an existing company, one of the best ways to keep it off track is to make it the providence of an internal incubator or accelerator, without actually figuring out where does the output go after it's gone through a demo. You know, one of the things in companies that has gone wrong is in dealing with disruption, we've kind of adopted a good chunk of startup language and tools and technology, but it mostly created innovation theater rather than real innovation. And the innovation theater kind of means that while we go through all the motions, we realize that the goal isn't a demo, that the goal is deployment or delivery to a customer of a product at scale that creates revenue and profit. And so one of the biggest problems with innovators is thinking that the goal is innovation. No, it's not. The goal in any company is sales and revenue and profit. Mm. And so if you're thinking that your goal is to be innovative, you're actually a burden on the company. You should be thinking about, no, I want to be innovative so I could deliver something that some salesperson in like Sydney is going to become the richest person in Australia because they're going to sell a lot of it. If that's not your goal, you're not actually helping the company. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And I find a lot of innovators confuse their role in the company, you know, forgetting that they're part of a company, not a nonprofit. And that requires understanding all the organizational judo and politics and whatever to get innovation delivered, not just demoed. It's great making a nice demo of an MVP that some VP says great, but you didn't realize it's going to, you know, put some other division out of business. And you never bothered to do. There's something that we didn't talk about that's critically important. In any existing company, if you're not doing internal customer discovery at the same time you're doing external customer discovery, you're dead on arrival because you don't realize all the other issues inside your company to get something delivered. Does this create channel conflict? Does this take, you know, money out of salespeople's pockets because, you know, they're going to have to do X versus Y? Does this, you know, break some laws or does, you know, what is legal going to say? Or, you know, there's a whole set of internal issues that startups don't have to deal with, but entrepreneurs inside of large companies, you know, get frustrated about only because they didn't do that discovery on day one. And by the way, in anything innovative inside of a large company, there's always a saboteur. And if you don't know who they are, I have yet to be in a large company with something innovative of somebody not feeling threatened, either for power, politics, or you know, dollars and or commission. And that's just the natural state of companies. But this could be not easily solved, but understood if you spend a good chunk of your discovery time internally as well. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I think it's a really important point. And, you know, going back to the example I shared earlier, one of the things we did there was look at the chimneys. We called them chimneys. So that was, you know, the various departments, so marketing and sales and research and product development and manufacturing and legal and HR, whoever else was involved there, and brought those and said, well, this project runs across those. So everybody gets involved from the beginning, including the customer. And so that was the kind of mechanism we had in place there for having that internal discovery as well.
Yep.
So, you know, there'd be things come up there, for example, that said, well, we can't, one of the ones I recall was an interesting one was, well, we can't share that information with the customer because it's confidential. And, you know, that's against our company legal policy. So the lawyers will, you know, we can't even write that in the secrecy agreement. And I remember having a long conversation about that one. In the end, we kind of changed the whole way we shared information with that particular customer. And that made a huge difference to the whole running of the project. And it never would have happened had we not involved the legal people up front, who, you know, at first said we can't do that, but then we did essentially a five whys type exercise. Why can't we do that? Why can't we do that? And then we got to the core of what the issues were, dealt with the issues, and then we were able to actually do something that they were happy with and got us a result.
So, Jurgen, multiply that by 1,000 going on every day in every company, except that most innovators inside of large companies don't find that out by the end, or get frustrated or think that that's not their job to figure out all those other issues. And by the way, that is also the role of the C-level is to be able to explain the difference between innovation and execution. You don't want, you know, some of these one-offs to become the standard because it would put the company out of business. But you do want for innovation projects, somebody to not have to ask for permission to get on an airplane to go visit a customer. So if you're in an innovation program, you might want to say, hey, those in this group, no, they have, you know, a travel budget. They don't need a permission for every travel, for example. Or in your case, you know, oh, yes, we can do these things because we're going to create a different standard for these types of customers and relationships. But for everybody else, no, we still follow the standard rules.
Yeah, really good point. All right, now what's the number one thing anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
So it's very funny. It's people tend to think of differentiation as, how do I make it up to be different?
Yeah.
I've always found that getting out of the building, people will tell you why you're different or explain to you. That is, you know, I've sat and got, you know, I probably could have like cut a year or two off of my marketing career thinking that I had to be and my group had to be the ones to come up with differentiation. You know, until one day I said, have we asked any of our customers why they think we're different? You know, and I remember being depressed. It was because, oh, sales is giving them a good kickback on whatever. Well, that's not a good, I guess we have to come up with one. So sometimes it's something you create. And gee, you know, advertising and marketing people like to tell you. But other times it comes from, and when I say customers will tell you, they won't tell you how to brand your company, but they will give you feedback on, well, because one of the questions you'll ask is, so who do we compete with? I used to like to ask that all the time. Oh, well, when I think of you, I think of these other companies. Well, when you think of those other companies, what do you think about each one of them? Oh, I think about X or Y. Well, when you think about us, what do you think about? And sometimes you don't like the answer, but sometimes you'll go, really? You think about it? And then you test that with a guy. Or then you start. So my answer to your question is, how do you differentiate yourself? Obviously, you could differentiate yourself on product features. You could differentiate yourself on service or all the classic things. But I, you know, there's a, and I don't mean to turn this into a long story, but I once took over marketing in a company coming out of bankruptcy that was making graphics boards for computers at the time when color graphics was a very expensive add-on. And when I took over marketing, I asked the department, existing smart people, what do people use our products for? Oh, for surveying and for this. And I got, after about 20 minutes, I realized we were going through the list of every possible industry. And I said, well, has anybody like actually talked to our customers? Silence. So I said, my first 3 weeks, I called over 300 customers and found out that 88% of our customers were in color desktop publishing. That's all they cared about. And by the way, when I started and I built a questionnaire to start asking them how they did their job, they only used 4 applications. And by the way, well, what did they care when they were buying our hardware or competitors' hardware? They only cared about, because it was their business to manipulate color images on the screen. The faster we could move something around, back then it was hard to believe. It took, you physically could see the pixels redraw on a screen for a detailed color image. Is every second we have to wait, we're losing money. And so speed matters. That's all that we care about. Well, no one in, not only in our company knew that, no one in our entire industry understood it was speed and that these were the customers that we had to target. And so pretty simply, our differentiation came from, we made the fastest, not technology, we made your job, you know, more productive. Does that make sense? And,
yeah,
and so differentiation came from basically first discovering and then understanding a day in the life of the customer and realizing that none of my competitors, in fact, the entire industry didn't realize where these things were being sold. We went from 11 to 68% market share in 2.5 years. Because, you know, I actually had more data than anybody because I said, you know what, I'm the new guy. I'm just going to play dumb. I don't know.
Yeah.
So anybody here know? And unfortunately, no one else did. And it became so important, by the way, that we took that because those were our customers. I realized our advertising and all the creative stuff we were outsourcing to understand our customers, we needed to bring it in-house. So we were actually doing the same job they were and eating our own dog food. And that gave us a deep understanding of the workflow of those customers. Just as an aside, by the way, once I started talking to those customers and found this out, to attend my staff meeting, everybody who worked in my department had to call two customers a week and ask them the same set of questions I did. Multiply that by eventually 40 or 50 people. I was talking to 100 or so people a week, 5,000 a year in person. And I had more data than anybody. And I could make moves and pricing moves and product moves and differentiation moves faster and better than anybody in the industry, not because I was smarter, but because I was deeply connected to that customer segment.
Mm. Yeah, no, that's a great story. And there's so much wonderful stuff to unpack there. So, you know, you're probably already different, but understanding what's important to the customer about how you're different is probably the key thing. And then
right.
being able to play on that strength is probably the other thing I'd take out of that.
Well, it bought my first house. We went public on that data.
Yeah. Great. Love it. All right. Well, thanks, Steve. This has been really fabulous. Now, where can people find out a little bit more about you, get a hold of all your books? I mean, I'm sure they're available on all the common bookstores,
yep.
but maybe there's a place where people can see them all and find out more and maybe even get in touch and say thanks for what you've shared with us today.
So I've been writing a blog for over 10 years. It's steveblank.com. Pretty easy to remember, steveblank.com. And there's a ton of stories about innovation, entrepreneurship, companies I did, classes I'm teaching, and things that might be of interest to your listeners. And take a look at the categories on the top and the tabs across the top as well.
Wonderful.
So all right. Thanks for having me.
We'll post the link in the show notes so people can click straight through to that. So do you have some parting advice for our listener today?
You know, for those who are affected, their businesses are affected by the virus. It's, you know, in the midst of all this, it's hard to remember that eventually the sun will come up.
Mm.
You know, and if you're healthy and safe, that's what matters. And if your family and people work for you are healthy and safe, that's number one priority. But businesses will recover. And there will be opportunities for new businesses, new products, new services. And hopefully you'll be the ones that are building them and delivering them.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's a really good message. You know, keep safe, keep well, but keep your eye on what's happening in change and what opportunities there are coming out of that.
Well, because out of crisis always comes opportunity.
Mm. All right. Now, finally, Steve, who would you suggest I chat with on a future InnovaBuzz podcast and why?
You know, I'm a fan of Pete Newell. Pete Newell in the U.S. Army ran what was called their Rapid Equipping Force, which might not seem relevant to commercial customers, but his job was on the battlefield to come up with new solutions at a blinding speed for life and death situations, which, you know, there are lots of lessons for large and small organizations. Now he runs a commercial company in Silicon Valley. And so I'm a big fan of Pete. If you haven't gotten Eric Reese, I, of course, would see if you could get Eric. You know, I'm sure there are some great venture capitalists in Australia that are looking at opportunities, or maybe ones in the U.S., but how has this changed how they look at new ventures and innovation, other than, you know, they're sitting at home in their pajamas as well, sitting on their pile of money. So I would be talking to some of those folks as well.
All right. Well, great. Thanks. So we'll reach out to Pete and Eric and mention your name. Maybe you can give us an introduction and we'll take a look at the venture capitalist space. I've got a few contacts in that. So we see some of the people there, how they're impacted on what's changing in the world today.
Great.
So thanks so much for sharing your time and your insights with us so generously, Steve. It's been a real privilege to have you on the show and to dig some more into your thoughts on Lean Startup and how that plays out, particularly today in our COVID kind of world. And I've really enjoyed this, had a lot of fun speaking with you, and I'm looking forward to sharing this with my audience. So all the best for the future and stay safe, and let's keep in touch.
Great. Same here. Take care.
Thanks.
I hope you enjoyed that enlightening and informative conversation with Steve and took something away from his episode. He shared some strong messages that resonated with me around customer discovery, building deep understanding of the problem beyond the symptoms, and developing connections between your expertise and possible solutions to your customers' problems. I'd love to know what you took away from Steve's episode. Leave a comment below the blog post, which you can find at innovabiz.co/Steve Blank. That is STEVEBLANK. All lowercase, all one word, innovabiz.co/Steve Blank. You'll also find contact information for getting in touch with Steve there, as well as links to his website and blog, which has a list of all his books too, and the other resources we spoke about in today's conversation. Steve suggested that we have a conversation with Peter Newell, CEO of the innovation company BMNT, and Eric Ries, author of the book on the Lean Startup Movement and also of the Startup Way, on future InnovaBuzz podcast episodes. So Peter and Eric, keep an eye on your inboxes for an invitation from us to the InnovaBuzz podcast, courtesy of Steve Blank. Tune in again to the next episodes of the InnovaBuzz podcast, where we've got more fantastic guests lined up, including Dr. Janine Garner, author of Be Brilliant, and Michael Roderick of Small Pond Enterprises. Thanks for listening to this episode. Make sure you subscribe to the show to be reminded of new episodes. It's free to subscribe. Leave a review if you like. Even if you don't like me, I'm okay with that. I'm asking you to leave a review because it helps other people find this show. Go to innovabiz.co to join our marketing transformation community and access a free gift my team and I made for you. It's the Marketing Master Mini Class. We want to give you everything you need to transform your marketing into a human-centered, relationship-focused growth engine. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember, be awesome and keep innovating.